Yeah, so thanks, Jim, and the organizers for setting up this meeting in this impressive theater. It's really a theater. I really like this. I'm happy to be here. And I can also say that just like Jim, I just recovered from the last conference in Poland where I got COVID. And so since 3 weeks, I'm fine again, but I can only agree with what Jim said. We still have to be careful. It was not fun, yes. Okay, so I'm going to report on our work in Stuttgart. You see, this is the skyline of Stuttgart. You can recognize this horse here, yes, which you maybe know from the logo of a Porsche car. That's where the cars come from Stuttgart. And the other logo that you can recognize here is the other big company that we have in Stuttgart that all of you know, okay? Good, but we are not going to talk about cars. We are going to talk about Rydberg molecules and a special kind of it. And before I get started, I want to introduce the team that is working on this project with me, which has senior group members Robert Löw and Florian Meinert. Some of you know them. And then a bunch of PhD students, Nico Zuber. This guy here is the senior one that was really responsible for most of the results that I'm going to show you, together with Virat, Moritz, and Yi-Chen. It's this guy for the most recent measurements. And then we have a former PhD student, Christian, who set up the ion microscope together with Nico and others, and a guest professor from Costa Rica, Oscar. Good. So this is going to show you first a new experimental device, a quantum gas microscope, if you like, which is pulsed very fast, and it detects ions. I will introduce that to you in a minute. And then I'm going to show you how we are using that microscope to look at molecules, yeah? Rydberg molecules of a new type. And if I have time at the end, I show you the most recent measurements where we are using not only the spatial resolution of that microscope, but also the very good temporal resolution. And we are going to look at the vibration of one of those molecules, so molecular dynamics in situ are resolved in space and time. Okay, so this is a theory place, so I start with an experimental apparatus right away. This is how it looks like. This is a machine that all of you know how they look like. You make some cold atoms here. But then the new thing is that we have an ion microscope to just look at a cold cloud of atoms. And that ion microscope detects the ions one by one by a standard technique. It's a multi-channel plate that can just count single ions. And whenever it counts them, it records the position, x and y, and the arrival time, t. And then to look at our sample, which is down here, the cold atoms, we have various lenses inside, actually, three lenses. These are just electrostatic lenses of the traditional type that are going to magnify anything that the ions do down here by a factor of 1,500 in the spatial dimension. Okay, so that is the place where the cold atoms actually sit inside here. So you see the atoms are surrounded by electrodes, which means we can compensate electric fields almost perfectly and then pulse on that microscope to look on the ion distribution. Okay, so this is like having cold atoms, let's say, in a tin can, yes, where we can watch them move. And that's actually the best way of detecting stray fields, yeah, which is an experimental problem, yeah? You never have a space with zero electric field. There's always some finite field, and you need to compensate it in three dimensions. So if you watch an ion move under that microscope, it's actually the best way, for us at least, to compensate the electric fields. So the first thing that this device can do is it can make very cold ions from a cold cloud. Yeah, you just photoionize them, microkelvin temperature. And then you can make this ion stand still. No trapping, no Powell trap, anything. it's just, you know, all the fields are compensated and the ion will just very slowly drift to the side by some finite residual electric field that we are not able to compensate. So then we have a zero field environment, and when we are interested on something to observe, like a nice object here, yes, we can just switch on our ion microscope and detect it, yes, and suck off the data that we want to detect. Okay, so this is a sketch of how this actually works. So at some time t equals zero, we create an ion in a cold cloud of atoms here, and then we can let this ion move around, drag it through some cloud or whatever, do something with it. Then at some time t2, we are pulsing on the ion microscope, and the time resolution is actually on the order of tens of nanoseconds, so very fast. We can switch on here a extraction voltage, which is about 500 volts, yeah, to extract those ions towards our MCP. And on the way, as I said, there's a magnification factor of about 1,500. So this is the extraction, and then here the data arrives on our detector. And I always like this picture because you also need to digest the data in the end. Yes, and we will come to that, what it actually means. So this microscope has a time resolution. Yeah, tens of nanoseconds is the time resolution. It has a very good spatial resolution, less than 200 nanometers, so better than the optical wavelengths, for example. So it's a little bit better than normal quantum gas microscopes. It can detect also in the third dimension, because due to the time of light to the detector, you get information about the Z direction along the axis of the microscope. And it also has a very large depth of field, because you are not diffraction limited by any means. You know, these ions have a very small de Broglie wavelength, so it's all like classical, and there's no wave limitation like in a normal quantum gas microscope. Okay, and as I said, we have, as we are observing single ions as they are moving here, we can control our electric field before we pulse on the microscope to a very high degree. Actually, like hundreds of microvolts per centimeter, or 100 microvolts per centimeter. So what can we do with it? Let's just remind everybody on this dark map of rubidium. Yeah. So what we are going to do is we are producing an ion. And then around this ion, there's an electric field. Yeah. And one thing, this is a Rydberg workshop, we can do is we can excite a Rydberg atom in the vicinity of that ion. Yeah. So the first thing that you see is that there are, of course, the Stark states that get attracted towards that ion because of the Stark effect. Yes, there will be a mechanical force that is pulling the Rydberg atoms into the ion. So if you do this with the, let's say, 129 S state, then this yellow line here is the potential energy surface that you get from that Stark map as a function of the radial distance from the ion. So the ion sits somewhere on the left here, and then you get this potential energy surface, which is purely attractive. And now you can excite around the ion, which is sitting here in the center, Rydberg atoms, and detect them around this ion. So that is what is called facilitated excitation in a finite field. So you see that the Rydberg atoms are excited in a shell, that the radius of which depends on the detuning of your excitation. Yes. So, and if you take this data and you just plot it as a radial distribution, this is actually the blue shaded data here, and it fits to that potential energy surface. So we can map out that potential energy surface around an ion by just doing an experiment like this. Now, of course, you can also use this microscope to study the dynamics. Now, as there are forces on that Rydberg atom, they're going to fall into that ion. Yeah? And this is just preliminary data. It's not yet fully analyzed, but you see what the microscope can do. The Rydberg atoms get sucked into the core of the ion. And there's some interesting dynamics. Yeah, you see that's not fully trivial, actually. Yes? And if you think about it, well, this potential energy surface has a lot of crossings with high L states here. And you might ask the question, are the Rydberg atoms actually following the yellow curve, or do they follow these deep potentials due to the crossing with high L states? And that's actually what we are analyzing right now. Another example is you just produce that ion in a cloud of atoms and you drag it along this, this cloud. And some of you may know that we have looked into this previously. So we had, let's say, a Bose-Einstein condensate or a thermal cloud. We create an ion at some place and we drag it to the right side in order to measure the mobility of that ion. And in our previous experiment, we were not able to do this in a spatially resolved way. We sort of had a complicated way of extracting that information from the time domain backwards. But now we can do this. So that's the old reference, actually, where we have measured the mobility as a function of or the mobility of the atoms or the current of the ion current as a function of the electric field. Now what we can do is we can take our cold cloud, which is this ellipse here. We can excite the ions in some place here. This is the red data, and then just drag it along to the right side. And if you look from the top, you can see that some of these ions move through the cloud without colliding, and others do some Langevin collision and are left behind in that scattering halo left behind in that scattering halo after such a collision. So you can study atom-ion collisions spatially resolved with this microscope. But today I want to focus on another application, namely that Rydberg molecule between, so a bound state between a Rydberg atom and a ion, and that to introduce this, let us look at this start map again. So what I have shown you so far is that maybe you excite some S state here, and then you are dragged into the high field region. That is this dynamics that I showed you here, and you might follow that S state into this manifold, or you might go even faster into the core by making a transition to the high L state. But if you look at this dark map closer, then you also find another interesting region, which is this one here, where there is an avoided crossing between attractive towards high fields and repulsive potential curves. Yes. So you might expect a bound state around that crossing, and you realize, okay, for rubidium, that's a P state. Yeah. So we do two-photon excitation normally. You would say a P state does not is not excited, but of course we have an electric field here, yes? And the electric field mixes in S and D characters, so eventually we can actually excite also around that crossing here. So if you convert this dark map now into a potential energy curve, again, the ion sits on the left side. Here is now the distance, yeah? You have a field that falls off. Then you see that here are our crossings that of interest. And now the important insight actually from these papers here, from the Reitel group and also Johannes Hecker-Denschlag's group, was that around this crossing, it's not enough to just calculate the Stark map. You have to take into account that the Rydberg atom is actually an extended object on the length scale of that crossing. And so you have to calculate the higher orders of the multipoles of the charge distribution of that Rydberg atom to get the right potential energy curves. Okay, and you have to do this up to the sixth order. And if you do that around that point, then you end up with potential energy curves that look like this. This is a zoom in of that region here. And another zoom in is shown here. And then when you do this, you get almost harmonic potential with a predictable vibrational frequency. In this case, this is the 54 P state. It has 11 megahertz vibrational splitting and the distance to another bound state here, which is 160 megahertz. So that's the prediction for the 54 P state. And the type of the binding of that molecule is sort of interesting, yes, because if you look at the Rydberg orbital on the right side of that harmonic oscillator, you see that the charge is on the left side, Whereas if you move to the other side, the charge is on the right side. So the dipole is constantly flipping as you are oscillating back and forth. Okay. So how do we do the experiment? Well, by now you know that we are exciting a cold ion in free space first, in this case by a two-color ionization pulse. This ion has a few microkelvin temperature. And then in the second step, we are exciting a Rydberg atom with this two-photon excitation to that crossing, to that P state that has an admixture of S and D characters, such that we can do that with the two photons. Then we wait for some time. We do something with this molecule. We let it decay or we let it oscillate later on. And then in a third step, we apply first a small electric field that is going to rip apart that molecule such that we first get the ion out and the Rydberg atom is left behind. And then finally, we ramp up the microscope to its full voltage, like 500 volts or so, such that we also field ionize the Rydberg atom. And as a consequence, on our MCP detector, we get two peaks, clearly separated, which allow us to differentiate between what was originally the ion and what was the Rydberg atom. Okay. And then we can look at it in real space or just look at the overall counts. Let's look at the overall counts as a function of the detuning. And you actually see nicely that predicted structure here. There's a separation here of 160 megahertz between that lower bound state and all the higher bound states. And you see that the vibrational splitting is predicted to be 11 megahertz, and that more or less fits exactly what we see in the vibrational spectrum, as well. Okay, so here is this molecule. Oops. Now you can convince yourself that it is really a molecule. It is really a bound state by doing a simple man's version of mass spectrometry, namely, you make this molecule here at the starting position at under your microscope, and you just apply, again, a very small electric field, 2 millivolts per centimeter, and drag that molecule or the single ions to the upper right corner. If you do it with single ions, then they move from here to here. If you do it with molecules, they just have twice the mass, so they are slower, yes, and so they are left behind. So this blue cloud is really the molecular signal telling you that even if you apply 2 millivolts per centimeter, these objects stay bound and can be dragged to the upper right corner, yes. So this is the distribution, and we can discuss the details if you are interested later. But this is one thing you can do with this microscope. But the other thing you can do is you can look at the distribution of Rydberg atoms in one of those vibrational states around the ion. And that was a surprise for us because initially we thought, okay, the electric field is isotropic and we should get an isotropic molecule here. Yes, but the microscope told us different. The molecule didn't look isotropic, okay? And then after thinking about it, it became clear that, of course, we do have a preferred direction here because of the polarizations of our excitation laser. Yeah? So what we actually have to consider is the matrix elements due to the two-photon excitation that we do with different polarizations. So, for example, we have a 780 nanometer laser with a linear polarization in this direction and this direction, which produces a preferred direction in the alignment or for the alignment of that molecule. Yeah. And we can check that theory, basically do the theoretical calculation, which is shown down here, looks more or less like the experimental observation. And if we change one of these polarizations, rotate it by 90 degrees, then the theoretical prediction and the experimental observation sort of follow that model. Yeah. We can also measure the bond length, which is about 4.3 micrometers, roughly what we also get from the theoretical model. Okay, so this is how the molecule looks like in situ, as looked at with the microscope. And now let's look at the spatial and temporal behavior of that molecule. What can we do? Well, if the ion sits here and we have a zero field around it, then on the left side of the ion along a z direction and on the right side, you get the same potential energy surface, yes? But as soon as you apply an electric field along that direction, what is going to happen is that the field of the ion and the external field add up or subtract from each other. So that means that the minimum is moving to the right on the right side and also to the right on the left side. On one side, it's moving closer to the ion. On the other side, it moves farther away. In addition, if you move closer to the ion on the left side, the inhomogeneity of the electric field increases. Therefore, these multiple terms in the potential energy curve also lead to an energy shift, which lowers the energy on the left side of the ion and raises the energy on the right side of the ion. Okay. So if you now excite this with a fixed detuning, let's say like this, then you are going to excite the ion mostly, in this case, on the left side of the ion. You are going to excite the Rydberg atom mostly on the left side of the ion. And you can do this systematically in the experiment. So that is the experimental data where you are plotting now the orientation, which is not the alignment, it's the orientation of the molecule. So you see example pictures here. This in zero field, the orientation is zero. That's the blue line, zero field. The pictures always look like this. You have as many atoms on the upper half and then on the lower half. But if you are now applying an electric field of a few millivolts per centimeter, then the picture changes, yes? For example, if you go to the red side, so you go a little bit lower here, you see that you are exciting only Rydberg atoms on the lower half of the picture, yes? Which if you do the average of the cosine theta, which is this angle here, gives you a finite orientation. Now you can measure that orientation as a function of detuning, that's the experimental data for different fields, and convince yourself, okay, that you are able to prepare a wave packet of Rydberg atoms on one side of the ions to start out with, okay? Now, if you take that situation as an initial wave packet and at a given time switch off the electric field, yes? Like, let's do it here. If we are switching it off, we go back to the old potential curve. As there was a shift in the position, this wave packet will now be an excited wave packet in this new potential curve, okay? And if you now look at the expected vibration of that molecule in real space, this is the calculation that you can do, you actually see that the motion of the ion on that side and the Rydberg atom on the other side has a very small amplitude. Yes, this amplitude is shown here. This is the radius between the ion and the Rydberg atom, and you see on the blue curve, okay, there is a oscillation, but the amplitude is actually 50 nanometers or less. Yes, so that's not enough for our microscope. We would not be able to resolve this directly. But then, of course, you know that in phase space, there's not only a spatial oscillation, but there's also an oscillation in momentum space. And that is plotted here in red. And you see that at the turning points, the velocity is zero, but on the other points where it goes through the equilibrium position, the velocity of the relative velocity of the ion and the Rydberg atom can be as large as half a meter per second. So actually, you can also see to scale here, yeah, the size of the Rydberg atom, the distance of that molecule, I mean the binding, the equilibrium position, and you see that although the nuclei are just moving a tiny little bit, the electron is doing a huge step from the left to the right side while this is going on. So in order to convert that momentum space oscillation to something we can observe with the microscope, we extend that dynamics here by a separation pulse that has a finite time, like 700 nanoseconds. That is enough to convert that momentum after ripping apart the molecule into a larger amplitude in real space. And that is our experimental data for this. So you see the oscillation, which is shown here. This is the experimental data. So we can fit a frequency to that data. You see that the amplitude is now 400 nanometers, so about a factor of 10 larger than what is actually happening in real space, yeah, because of that wait time in the separation pulse here. And you see that there's a little bit of a damping. Now you can try to understand that in some detail. To you do either classical or a quantum calculation. There's not a big difference, yeah, because the vibrational quantum number that we are exciting is actually pretty large. 5, 6, 7 is the vibrational quantum number. So you don't expect a big difference between a classical and a quantum calculation. But what you see is that there's also a damping here. And that is due to the unharmonicity in the potential. Yeah, it's not a perfect harmonic oscillator. And the frequency that we determine from that classical simulation is close to the one that we are measuring in the experiment, not exactly, but close to it. Okay, so we can see that molecule vibrate. That brings me already to my summary and the outlook. I showed you that we can detect this new Rydberg atom molecule in real space with the angular distribution that shows an alignment here due to the two-photon excitation and the polarizations of the light field that we can control. Yeah? We can see that the molecules stay bound even in a small electric field that drags them along under the microscope. And we can observe the vibrational dynamics of that Rydberg molecule directly. In the future, this microscope can also be applied to all kinds of other situations. I showed you some preliminary data on Rydberg chemistry already, where we see how the Rydberg atoms are sucked into an ionic core. That's certainly interesting and is in the progress of being analyzed right now. But in general, you can also look at other situations. Just even if you're not exciting Rydberg atoms, just looking at ions as an impurity in a quantum gas like a Bose-Einstein condensate or a Fermi gas would be particularly interesting, as the spatial resolution of that microscope is better than length scales of interest. Like, for example, the Fermi lengths in a lithium Fermi gas. So one should, for example, be able to see Friedel oscillations, yeah, around an impurity or at some edge. I already showed you also that ion atom collisions can be observed directly in interesting regimes, also in the case of Fermi gases, for example. And in the lithium case, it's also promising to enter the quantum regime because there the temperatures that we can achieve are below the S-wave limit. And then, of course, you can look at Rydberg-Rydberg correlations. For example, in the Rydberg-blockaded ensemble, you could look at the distribution of Rydberg atoms in real space. And for these molecular ions, of course, it's tempting to not only excite a single Rydberg atom, but maybe two Rydberg atoms in that potential energy surface. And now you also have an interaction between the Rydberg atoms, yeah, which in normal trilobite type of molecules is typically not the case. But here, as we have two Rydberg atoms as a part of the molecule, there might be strong interactions between all the three particles, yeah, and have interesting that may have interesting correlations. Okay, so at the end, I show you our team. This was our hiking trip about 3 years ago, and that is the hiking trip just 1 week ago. you see, we like to go to the mountains, and we had to stop doing this for like the last 2 years. Because of the pandemic, but now we did it again. And if you find this kind of work interesting, of course, we are hiring PhD students and postdocs. Thank you for your attention.
question?
Yeah, okay.
Okay. Oh, wait, you have to.
I have a quick question regarding your potential, the form of the potential in the first slides. Is this 1/4, r to the fourth? What is the shape of the potential? So the power law that you get.
Which one? This one?
No, before, way before that. This one.
This one?
Yes.
This is a 1/r^4 potential.
1/r^4.
Okay. Because you have a field that falls off, like 1/r².
Okay.
And then you have a polarizability.
Yes, yes.
And then it goes like alpha e squared.
But you didn't observe any deviations from this power law.
So, of course, yeah, that's the rough first estimate, yeah. And then, but if you look into the details, you see that the structure is actually a little bit more complicated, okay. Yes, especially if you take these inhomogeneities into account.
Okay. Yeah. And concerning the final comment on the immersion of these ions in Bose-Einstein condensates, how far are we of getting a true one-component plasma mixed with the BEC?
We can make a single ion in a BEC. We have done that and observe it. If you ask about the polaron physics around that ion, then you can be optimistic and hope for the coherent dynamics of many atoms that are just scattering elastically in that potential, and that's interesting. But on the same scale, there are also inelastic processes going on, because the length scale of that 1/r^4 potential here compared to the length scale of the mean particle distance, yeah, is comparable. Yes, that's actually quite different from the polaron physics in neutral gases. Yes, where the three-body recombination can be suppressed. But I would say it's still an open question how to suppress the three-body recombination between an ion and two ground state atoms. In such a system. If one can come up with a nice idea, this is a place where ideas are born, I understand. So that's actually one of the challenges, yes? How do you shield the system from undergoing inelastic free body in order to observe the more interesting strongly correlated polaron physics than as compared to the weakly interacting polaron physics in other systems?
If there is time for another question, please. You present your data with a fixed ion.
Yes.
You get the information of the ion independently of the Rydberg,
yes.
And you can reposition. But I guess that they're actually rotating around each other.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, in this experiment where you induce a kick by switching off the electric mm-hmm. field. So you switch off, but you could rotate the electric field to induce a rotation. And then it would really be a rotating molecule
mm-hmm.
and with a lot of implications and interesting physics to look at, I guess.
Yes. So first of all, yeah, thank you. I didn't really mention this. We are detecting the ion and the Rydberg atom in a separate peaks in time of flight. And what I'm plotting here is always the relative distance between the two. Yeah? The ion cloud and the Rydberg cloud look more or less, if you look at them independently, like in this mass spectrometry data, like here. Yes, so it's like a fuzzy cloud. But all we are interested in here is the relative distance between the two. Once the ion is here, we detect the Rydberg atom here, and then we get these nice images. Okay. So, and now you were referring to this, whether we should rotate the electric field. We can do that, yes. We can spin it around. We haven't done it yet. The rotational constant, if you want to do something, let's say, quantum here, is, however, disappointingly small, yeah, because that's a huge molecule. You have seen the binding length is 4 micrometers, yes? So the rotational constant is so small that you cannot resolve anything, yes? Because the lifetime, I didn't talk about this, the lifetime of the molecules is also limited. Yes, it is only 10 microseconds or something. So it wouldn't even last for a full rotation, yes, at least for a fixed rotational state.
Yeah, thank you for the talk. A few open-ended questions, possibly material for further discussion. So how much of that physics relates to solid-state materials if we were to think about the application to quantum simulations?
So this is so the first part that I showed you, the molecular physics, I would say is fundamental molecular physics, not directly related to solid-state physics. But the polaron physics that I was referring to at the end, I think is directly related to strongly correlated polarons that you find also in condensed matter.
I think in general, like, there's interest in developing new materials for batteries, and in general, the idea is to study this idea of ion transport. And towards that, I was wondering if there would be any ways to extend optical access. So, for example, in your BC, can you, for example, add spatial order into this background?
Of course, yes. We can do anything that we want to our cold cloud before we do this kind of experiment. For example, apply an optical lattice with a periodic density modulation. That's easily possible.
And now in terms of extending, so combining this with optical access, so what I was thinking, so imagine you had alkaline earth atoms, so this core ion has some polarizability, and then you could have some optical landscape. So would that be any interesting?
Of course, yes. So if you were to do this, let's say, with strontium or ytterbium or so, then this ion can be further manipulated with periodic potentials, for example, yes, like optical lattices that are acting only on the ion, not on the ground state atoms, for example. Yes?
Yeah, correct.
Now, the rubidium here, the polarizability, as it's a closed shell, the rubidium plus has almost no polarizability, so it's going to be a little bit hard. Yeah, you need a lot of power to do that. That's why the earth alkalis sort of are advantages.
And in terms of time scale and spatial scale, would that be so? If we were to combine, so add to that optical potential and modulate on microsecond time scales.
Whether I have I don't have it. We can resolve optical lattices with this microscope, actually, yes? The spatial resolution is good enough to see an individual site in such an optical lattice and resolve it, yeah?
I see. And now if you correlate your optical measurement with the this ionization measurements, is there any additional interesting information that you get out of that?
You say we should combine this with a conventional optical quantum gas microscope.
Yeah, correct. So you could say it's redundant information.
So that's not what this machine is able to do. Yeah, but it's sort of an interesting suggestion to think about a combination of an optical quantum gas microscope with this ion quantum gas microscope, and then at that point, of course, you can also start thinking about correlations. Yes. Between neutral atoms that you are detecting optically and ions that you are detecting by that ion microscope.
Correct, and then you can add spatial order to your background atoms, and then you can add spatial temporal
modulation. You can see how the way
the
I would do it experimentally is I would first produce this ion, yes, and then when I want to see the neutral guys around it, I would just photoionize them later and see their signal and do the correlation measurement this way. Yeah.
I see, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thanks for talk. I have a question on the avoided crossing, which you use to form the molecule. I imagine that the gap in this avoided crossing is, I don't know, rather small. And so...
You see the gap is here.
Okay.
It's 100 megahertz or something, 160 megahertz. Yeah.
Okay, then maybe so my question is basically if the atom during the oscillation moves too fast, then somehow it will...
Yes, absolutely.
And
that's
a very good question.
The question is this adiabatic here, yes, the oscillation, or can there be a non-adiabatic transition to other states? And indeed, that is possible. It has been calculated, actually, also. And it's one way, one channel that leads to a finite lifetime of these molecules. Yes. However, the predicted lifetimes from that non-adiabatic model are much too long. We measure much shorter lifetimes, and they are more mundane, I would say. They basically come from, I think, from unshielded radio frequency fields in our experimental chamber that induce transitions, just because these are huge dipole moments that are involved between Rydberg states and a tiny little bit of radio frequency, spurious radio frequency that we get from somewhere, make a transition from that state to another state, and then the ion is broken and gone. The molecule is broken and gone. Yes. Okay, that's good.
You have two questions. Should we?
Thank you so much. I have a rather general question, maybe regarding experiment where you drag your ion through the BEC. If I'm not mistaken, I saw a plot where you have the average velocity or something like that.
Yes, this one.
More generally wondering, did you also analyze the velocity correlations? And if so, what would be the accuracy? The background of the question is that, I'm not sure if you heard of that, but there's this rather recent field for 6, 7, 8 years now, where they try to determine lower bounds on such currents, which goes under the name of thermodynamic uncertainty relations. And I was wondering if you could get anywhere near such bounds.
No, we should talk about this. This is actually a very interesting comment. So what we are measuring here is the saturated drift velocity after we apply an electric field. Yeah? So if you have an ion, of course, if there's nothing in the way, you would just expect an accelerated motion. But due to the presence of many atoms that you're scattering, it's like in the Drude model, yes, you get a constant drift velocity after some time. And that's the drift velocity that we are measuring as a function of the electric field. So just like in standard solid-state physics, yeah, you get a relation between the current and the field that you are applying. Yes. So in that sense, we are measuring, that's the slope here, the resistivity or the mobility of the ions. Yes. But we have not looked into any correlations. It's just a single ion in this case that is dragged through the medium. Yes. If we were to have a second ion, then the interaction between those ions would be very strong. We would get very strong correlations, I guess. And they override all the interesting scattering physics because they would just fly apart. There would be a Coulomb explosion. Yeah. But maybe there is some more stuff to discuss later. I find this very interesting. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So in the orientation thing that you had, I didn't understand those results.
This is the alignment, and this is the orientation.
Yes.
Yeah.
So from the explanation, I guess I would have expected this to be symmetrical around delta equals zero, whereas it's...
Yes, okay. No, it's not.
Peaked on the left and nothing on the right.
Yes. So very good question. Thank you, Francis. So on the left side here, you have only a single state that you can excite here, and so you expect an orientation on the red side. On the blue side, however, with the same electric field, you can excite this state, but you can also excite many excited vibrational states here, and they are equally distributed. That's why the orientation goes back to zero here on the blue side.
Okay.